Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, I will assume that most of us know the major factors of technology, and I will just spend a few minutes summarizing what I consider to be the significant aspects of modern technology and then draw conclusions of a political nature. We are living in a universe today which is characterized by the fact, first, that technology is an overriding factor. Second, that contrary to what some people are telling us, no technological plateau has been reached, but on the contrary, technology is moving ahead at an accelerated pace, so that at the present moment, both in technology and science, we have a doubling rate of every 10 to 15 years. There is no way to stop this technological advance. You can influence it to some extent, but by and large, technology is an impersonal force, and it just moves. The outstanding factors, of course, of modern weapons are speed, range, the fact that weapons are used in four dimensions, by which I mean, of course, space and the three dimensions on the globe. The firepower is quite considerable, despite many exaggerations which have influenced our political thinking. One of the greatest problems is the danger of a sudden attack, an attack which could be launched and could be over within a matter of a few hours. Concurrent with these developments, we have the fact that the cost or the resources required for modern technology exceed the capabilities of most states as presently constituted, including perhaps the United States, certainly including the Soviet Union. Not in the sense that you cannot and we do not develop modern technologies, but in the sense that whenever a new major development has to be initiated, the price tag being somewhere in the neighborhood of $20 to $50 billion, people draw back. Resource is not just financial, the resource is human. Many other factors involved, including territorial limits, including international arrangements, and so on and so forth. The principle of sovereignty, as it was known to us, is still, of course, valid as a legal concept, as a concept as to who makes the ultimate decision in a given society. But the capability of carrying out sovereign decisions in military affairs today is restricted to perhaps two states, the United States and the Soviet Union, and a closer look shows that some of that is deceptive too. We have heard yesterday several comments on the morality of war, and today again the question was raised whether one of our problems is not the lack of willingness to die for our ideas. I will not enter into the question that, which I take for granted really, that if you have principles, the ideals, you have to die for them, otherwise you don't have these ideas or principles. But I will try to take a somewhat different tack by pointing out to you that I think that the immorality today is perhaps the failure of policy to take measures to prevent war. Now, I do not imply by this that it is absolutely a foregone conclusion that you can prevent war under all circumstances. I do mean that we have had experiences, certainly in this century, several times over, which indicate very clearly how, practically speaking, concretely speaking, you are able to prevent wars. And the answer is very simple, primitive. If you are superior in power, if your side owns a supremacy of power, you will prevent war. Probability, let us say, is 1 to 1,000 that this, or rather 1,000 to 1, that war will not occur even as an accident. Now, we have had a demonstration of this in the Cuban crisis. The Cuban crisis proved two things. First, that the Soviet Union, contrary to the soothsaying which comes out of Washington, has not forsaken the use of nuclear weapons to advance its objectives, and cannot, incidentally, forsake it. But it also proved that when we showed that we were willing, or at least seemed to show that we were willing to take them up, they drew back. In normal statistical terms, our superiority in the Cuban crisis was about 5 to 1 on the international ICBM intercontinental scale. Unfortunately, we were already in 1962 in a disadvantageous situation, inasmuch as Europe suffering from a missile gap. It's rather interesting to show how our public minds today are conditioned by public relations releases and election campaigns. There was a danger that there would be a missile gap arising by 60-61. It did not arise for a number of reasons, and we are very happy about it. But actually, the missile gap did arise in Europe, not in terms of ICBMs, where we hold at present, presumably, if we are to believe Mr. McNamara, and those are very broad and very important qualifications, we do hold a superiority. But it is not even disputed that the Soviets have 700 to 1,000 medium-range ballistic missiles pointed against Europe. There's no defense in Europe against those missiles. There's no counter-weapon against those missiles. Now, this raises the whole NATO problem to which Robert Stossupé referred in a broad manner. NATO is a dead duck, unfortunately. But it isn't going to come to life again unless we change our policy fundamentally on these technological matters. But that, again, isn't going to happen just because we change it in the United States. There is a need for the Europeans to change, too. If we think we have difficulties to get these points across, we are right. But we should never forget that it is even more difficult to get the points of national defense or Western defense across in Europe than it is in the United States. The long and short of it is that we have set out originally to create an alliance which was more than an alliance, which was a body. We talked about integration. This was perhaps always a little dreamy, but it indicated the general direction which we were desirous of going. We wanted to get the main nations of Europe and North America together and organize together, doing great things together, to paraphrase Hippolyte Taine. This has not happened. We have had Article 2 in the NATO Treaty. Robert Stossupé has made many efforts to put life into this article. The article is dead. What we need is more than a few military institutions under the heading of SHAPE. We need a large number of new institutions in the political area. And I don't mean we need another parliament in Strasbourg. We have to organize in such a way that we grow together. We have organized in such a way that our mutual comprehension of our mutual problems is increasing. This means, for example, in terms of our society here, that it is not advisable just to talk in America to Americans. When we have international cooperation in the intellectual sphere today, you usually find that Americans talk to Germans, and Germans talk to Americans, and occasionally you meet a few Englishmen, and then a very occasional Frenchman, and that's about it. That's a very sorry state of affairs, but unless this international cooperation becomes first an intellectual cooperation, the very concrete problems of defense cannot be solved. Now, there's another very broad area which cuts right across this whole discussion on whether we talk about civilization or Western civilization. And that is the problem of the Soviet Union. We, in a very lazy fashion, equate things which should never be equated. We equate Russia, the Soviet Union, Soviet with communism, the Soviet Union with the communist state, and so on and so forth. All these things are disparate. We have no quarrel with the Russians. We have no quarrels with the Soviet Union. We have a quarrel with the communist dictatorship, or, as a matter of fact, even leaving out the word communist, the Kremlin dictatorship and the Kremlin dictatorship. What I mean by this is simply that political development inside the Soviet Union is part of our problem. What I mean is furthermore that there are inside this Iron Curtain, inside this so-called federation, people who think like we do, who have the same ambitions, the same goals as we have them, who are mute, who are beaten down, and who get support from nowhere. The development, in one way or the other, of the Soviet system is one of the crucial factors in our modern life. We can discuss this problem in military terms, and we should, we must. I want to leave no question on that point. But after all, if it is possible to bring about, or to help along, or to initiate, and you can be as cautious on this as you want to, constructive developments inside the Soviet Union, this is certainly worthwhile trying. We cannot afford to have a Western-centristic attitude and say what happens behind the Iron Curtain is of no concern to ourselves, except that we always have to consider these people are our enemies. Now, our enemies are behind the Iron Curtain, but not all of the people behind the Iron Curtain are our enemies. The intellectual development in terms of political sciences in Russia, I use the term deliberately now, has always been fired from the outside. There has never been much free speech in the Russian area. There has never been much creative thinking on political matters in this area. This is one point where I completely agree with Brent Brazil that we should never, under any circumstances, leave any doubt about the superiority of our political thinking, certainly in comparison with the Russian traditions. But there was political thinking. Most of it was done in Switzerland and in other parts of Europe. Today, no such political thinking is taking place because it cannot. And with all our resources, we are not providing these people with the forum which they need in order to break the ice. And it is certainly not overly optimistic to assume that the ice can be broken, because the ice is breaking in many ways. Let us have the courage of our convictions. If we feel that communism is a bad system, we must assume that it doesn't work too well. And if that is the case, and I think the case can be documented quite well, then we must also assume that unless we make the other assumption that all these people behind the Iron Curtain are stupid, that these people know it. Now, they know it better than we do, in fact. But the trouble is that there have been no alternatives. They know what's ailing them. They don't know how they can improve it. They don't know how they can change it. And that, I think, is one of the greatest failures of the West, that it has not seen fit to make sure that these people behind the Iron Curtain know that there are alternatives and help them figure out how the alternatives can be applied to their concrete situation so that an evolution, maybe of sorts, maybe inadequate, maybe ultimately culminating, because evolutions do this often, in a catastrophe which maybe again leads into a war. But nevertheless, an evolution in the right direction could be put in motion. And this has to be done in a discussion of concrete ideas rather than generalities, because the generalities are not understood by these people. So American conservatism is a term which we should treat with a great deal of caution. Obviously, we are Americans. We have to have our own thought or philosophy or whatever it is. But if it's only restricted to America, it is going to fail. And it is going to fail because this period where one country, even as big as the United States, thinks it's out of the mainstream of history, that time is over. We participating in the mainstream of history. One last point. When we talk about freedom, and yesterday the question was asked whether anyone could really define freedom around here, I wouldn't be too pessimistic about this. But I think we do tend to the cliche. Let me make one very important distinction. We talk about, when we talk among Americans, usually about personal freedom. I don't have to stress the importance. But we should never forget, and we always forget, to talk about national freedom. National freedom and personal freedom are interrelated. And national freedom is one of the greatest values in the world, and it is one of the values which is none in existence today behind the Iron Curtain. The American Revolution was a national revolution. The Declaration of Independence is the beginnings, or at least in modern times, of the principle of self-determination. These are broad subject matters. If we forget them, we are not talking. We are maybe talking to the Russian, but we are not talking to the Ukrainian. We are not talking to the Uzbek. We're probably not even talking to the Pole. Now, while we have to analyze these problems in a futuristic, forward-looking way, not in the sense of nationalism, as it got a bad name, and rightly so, in the first part of the century, we also have the problem of putting together supranational arrangements, such as federations or something else, such as common markets, because the future of our side of NATO is dependent on going beyond, but not abolishing, national freedom. And it is the appeal of the common market, and it is the possibility of supranational organization, which bears in itself the seed of an arrangement through which, in one way or the other, maybe this great monster of the communist empire can be dismantled. And this, everything is said and done, is the task we must confront. So we have, as it was pointed out yesterday, an organizational problem, but we need new concepts of organization, And ladies and gentlemen, we need new concepts of organization dealing with the state, in addition to many other things. State structure is in dire need of overhaul everywhere, and we will do the job better if we approach it from the point of view of the international requirements rather than the national requirements. Western decline, which Frank Meyer was impressed by so dramatically yesterday, is a reality. However, I take it with the old traditionalist writer, the French or Piemontese de Maistre, who always thought that pressure or even war has a very constructive function to fulfill in life. I think the Western civilization has a great chance that in the fact that communism is a very potent and a very worthy opponent. It is a whip of God, but without that whip, we will never move.